I run with the blue horses of electricity who surround the heart and imagine a promise made when no promise was possible. These words by poet Joy Harjo are the opening gloss of Elizabeth Rosner's latest novel, Electric City. I'm Suzanne Lang, and it's a novel idea. Coming up later in the broadcast, I'll talk with Jessica Barksdale Inclán on her latest work of chick lit, her witty and warm, as in cookies fresh out of the oven warm, How to Bake a Man. So stay with us. It's KRCB's A Novel Idea. Poet and novelist Elizabeth Rosner grew up in Schenectady, New York, the daughter of Jewish Holocaust survivors, and much of her work reflects her coming to terms with how her parents' experiences have affected her own life and identity. I encountered her work several years ago and was drawn by her poetic language that deftly evokes mood and place. Her latest novel, Electric City, just out from Counterpoint Press, is a coming-of-age love story set against the backdrop of a company town in upstate New York that once called itself the city that lights the world. Here's my conversation with Elizabeth Rosner. Thank you for coming to Sonoma County and welcome.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Some of our readers and listeners may be familiar with your other work, but before we start on Electric City, your latest book just released from Counterpoint, I'd like to remind people of what some of your other work is.
Great.
Your first novel, The Speed of Light.
Yes, that was my first.
Yes. Well, why don't you describe in your words the story?
Well, it's always fun to try and come up with the perfect soundbite, but I usually say that that novel is about three different people coming to terms with a traumatic history that they carry and how they help one another heal from that by sharing their stories. And if that sounds too abstract, more concretely, it's the story of a brother and sister living in Berkeley who grew up in a very silent family with a Holocaust survivor father who never spoke about his story. And as adults, that brother and sister get to know a woman who is a refugee from Central America who, in a similar way, carries a tragedy with her. And ultimately, all three of them discover that they can help one another live in the world by sharing their stories.
And it has these three distinct voices of these characters going on. And it seems to really be kind of exploring that balance between what you have to carry alone or what you do carry alone and what you need to share.
That's a great way of putting it. Thank you. I really feel that even though that story came very much out of my personal experience growing up as a daughter of two Holocaust survivors, I came across many other descendants of survivor families who actually never spoke about the past inside their home. And that kind of silence always fascinated and disturbed me, even though I have a lot of empathy for survivors who find themselves unable to talk about their experiences. But I really did want to explore what is the possibility for bringing those stories into language. What are the places you can't go, and what are the places you can find your way toward with the right kind of connection? But it is also a story about people who feel isolated and separated. And in a way, that theme runs through a lot of my work. It's that question of how do we reach across these giant, invisible chasms that sometimes people feel and don't know how to leap over. And I really think that one of my roles as a writer is to help people bridge those distances.
Because it's something that you have struggled with yourself?
I have such a complex sensitivity, I think, to that question of what we inherit, what stories are given to us to carry, and how we negotiate letting go of the things that don't really belong to us and yet honoring the things that are given to us to do and say. And even though I'm very respectful toward my parents' stories as being their experiences not lived by me, I really feel that in some way what I inherited was the obligation to keep those stories alive in some sort of way.
These stories, whether they're told or whether there's silence, even in that silence, there is a story that is inescapable to that next generation. We all carry something, and whether we choose to actually embrace that is the issue.
Well, I was really so touched when that novel first came out with Random House. And of course, part of the marketing strategy is to come up with this perfect little tagline for a book. And what they came up with was every family has a story. Every story eventually must be told. And what I've discovered over the years, because that book came out in September 2001, it actually came out a week before 9/11, and I have a lot of stories I can share the strangeness of that timing. But the point for me was that I kept discovering that people were responding to that book not only because they had a similar history to mine, but because they had some secret in the family that had been guarded very carefully. And it really did seem that every family had something that was the family story, and sometimes it was the family secret or the unspoken hidden truth about the family. And it could be anything from the uncle who committed suicide and nobody ever wanted to mention that person's name, or it was a teenage pregnancy that, you know, the baby was given away and no one ever spoke about that, or, you know, all these things that generation after generation get covered up.
And when you're growing up and you sense that something is wrong, well, you don't know that it's not something being unsaid. Right. And sometimes we grow up maybe even with a sense of animosity towards our parents, not realizing the deep-seated pain that comes from that.
Well, and that's why I said, although I have tremendous empathy for the decisions people make about their own stories and whether to tell them or not, whatever the story is, whatever the secret is, I have learned by my own experience and through others that a lot of damage is done in the name of, sometimes they say, protecting the children from this story, or we didn't want to hurt anyone by naming names. But the children feel and sense when something's being withheld, and then we carry that into our own adulthood. And I think that becomes burdensome in its own way.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So that is the speed of light that we're talking about, and I think that the tagline or encapsulated blurb, it really doesn't do the whole book justice for the way the stories unfold and these three people. It really is a very fluid read.
Thank you.
And then Blue Nude is a book that I particularly melted into when I read it. And I think its setting out at Point Reyes is very atmospheric, and I thought it was very evocative. And just as in your current book, Electric City is really steeped in place, and it's almost a palpable character in the book.
Thank you for saying that. Yeah, I really did experience that much more with Blue Nude, and especially with Electric City, that notion that place can be a kind of character. So with Blue Nude, in many ways, it really was the book I could only have written after writing The Speed of Light, because in a way, one of the messages of Blue Nude is the possibility for the creative process to help us discover ourselves and in some ways to liberate ourselves from who we thought we were supposed to be. And it does still continue in some ways the theme of inheritance from the Holocaust, but it's taking on the German side of the story, and that was partly based on a process I went through with descendants of Nazis and descendants of survivors coming together to talk to each other and to reveal ourselves to one another through our stories. And I really discovered, to my profound amazement, how much we had in common, and that once we could really look each other in the eye and humanize each other, then we could begin to shed that layer of pure victim, pure perpetrator, as though those were fixed categories, and instead there was this amazing blurry zone of connection and intimacy. And the place, in many ways, what I discovered about place in that novel was the way we can try to escape our histories by leaving home. You know, the German character Danzig in Blue Nude goes far away from Germany and his Nazi father, but discovers that he's really carrying a lot of that with him. And the young woman, Mirav, who's moved to America from Israel, also has this inescapable question about her identity being based on the place she's from, just as much as it is on the place where she has chosen to live. And as my own experience growing up on the East Coast, but migrating to California as a college student, you know, I still feel that California is my adopted home. And I think that I also kind of learned that from my parents in a way, that they could only Americanize so much. They still had their accents. They still had their childhood resonance that carried with them from Europe. And it wasn't just the Holocaust that they carried. It was, my mother was from Eastern Europe. My father was from Germany. They had those cultural qualities that lived on. And so by the time I had lived in California for more than 20 years, almost 30 years, it suddenly occurred to me, as if in a revelation, that it was really time for me to write about the place that I came from, which wasn't California. It was upstate New York.
And that is the setting of Electric City, which is set at the confluence of the Mohawk and the Hudson River. And I'm not sure if it was just the way you described it or if I was recalling other literature, American history or something, but something felt so home about it. Mm. And I'm wondering if that's because of the very opening of the book. And I'm going to ask you to read that. Would you mind?
Sure, I would love to. Before the name Electric City, there were other names, and before those names, there were no names at all. The river carved itself into the valley, remembering everything. Pines thickened and pushed against the sky. Autumn went dark, then ghostly, freezing into the hibernation of winter. Spring resurrected the landscape and the creatures that filled it, painting the scenery back to life. Summers shimmered with wet heat until fall erupted into a riot. The story repeated and repeated, the same and yet not the same, year in and year out. The Hudson was known as the river that flows both ways, or Mohayunkatuk, and sometimes simply the river, as though the only one. Tributaries were referred to by their outer banks, shadowed by the trees best suited for canoe making. There was Shenatade, water beyond the pines, and also Andiatarkote, or here the lake closes, later, much later, to be known as Lake George. Seneca, Cayuga, Onondaga, Oneida, and Mohawk people braided themselves into a confederacy with the name Haudenosaunee, building longhouses beneath the great evergreen tree, making shelter under the deep-rooted pine with its eagle hovering above. The collective of voices agreed to put down the weapons of war and let the waters wash them away. Even when the longboats watched the arrival of the Van Curlers, curiosity became regret only after it was far too late. Surely there were meat and fish and grain enough to feed all of them, enough flat ground for planting on, enough wide sky to worship toward. We know you have arrived and are not leaving. Tribal arguments were as old as the mountains, but those wounds always healed eventually when tended with proper care, blessed and forgiven. Now these darker-skinned and lighter-skinned alliances gave way once again to wars, followed by burying of the innocent and the guilty side by side. Uneasily borrowing each other's language, awkward hesitations and gestures filling the spaces in between the mispronounced words, the longboats and Van Curlers negotiated dividing, took turns being the teacher and the student. It was at first strange and then common to call places by the names of people instead of using words to describe nature belonging only to itself. We know you have arrived and are not leaving.
Those are the opening pages of Elizabeth Rosner's just released book, Electric City. Elizabeth, this book really strikes me as a meditation almost on loss, mm-hmm. on love and family and deep family.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in that opening paragraph, you mention two of the family characters that are in the book, the Van Curlers, mm-hmm. a Dutch family mm-hmm. from way back,
mm-hmm.
and the Longboats, who also go way back. And then there are the Levines, who are also Dutch, but a little bit newer in their arrival to the
right.
country.
Yeah, I really wanted the story to be an embodiment of these multi-generational threads of intertwined history. And the Longboats, who really are my invention, but I want to believe, I actually met a Mohawk man many years ago whose family name was Longboat, and they came from Schenectady, so I borrowed that name for my characters. And there were a lot of names in Schenectady with a van something because it was settled by the Dutch in the 1600s. And so the Van Curler name was one of the ones I chose to use. And then the Levine family, Sophie Levine is the character most easily mistaken for me, I guess, even though she's my alter ego, but she's 10 years older than I am. I wanted her to be of a certain age by the time certain events happened historically, and including, for example, most dramatically, the Great Northeast Blackout of 1965.
I'll say that some of the blurbs I've read of this book call it a coming-of-age story, and it is certainly that. But it does the whole notion of nature and of electricity and you using that throughout the book, I thought was an interesting juxtaposition, as well as some of the characters mm-hmm. of Steinmetz and the older Longboat. So what was the genesis of that, of Electric City and the larger issue of a blackout?
When I had that epiphany that I was describing a few minutes ago about realizing it was time finally to write about the place I came from, I called my father and told him that I was going to be writing about Schenectady. It just really seemed like once I decided that, there was no going back or changing my mind. I needed to write about this place. And I was probably intending at that point to really mostly draw on my own memories of growing up there and fictionalize that somehow. But my father, the first thing he said was, you should write about Charles Steinmetz. And I had no idea who he was talking about. That name didn't mean anything to me. But there was something about the way my father said it that got me curious, and I decided to do some investigating. And right away, the first few things I discovered about this character, he was a character. He just was immediately the kind of character that a novelist can only dream of discovering, because there was so much about him that was quirky and eccentric and brilliant, and it just stimulated my imagination on so many levels.
And he was an immigrant.
There are so many parallels. This is the other thing. So he actually came to America just before the turn of the 20th century, late 1890s, 1896, and almost got turned away on arrival because of his physical deformities. He was a dwarf. He was a hunchback. He was not a promising American from the doctor's point of view, who, you know, examined everyone on arrival. And he happened to have a friend, a Danish-American friend who had traveled with him, who started waving money around and persuaded the officials that Steinmetz should enter. And he turned out to be this incredibly significant figure in the development of electricity. He was discovered by Edison. He was brought to Schenectady at the time when Edison was just beginning to establish the General Electric Company there. And all of this, on the one hand, was really intriguing to me. And yet, on the other hand, there wasn't that much that had been written about him. There were a few sort of famous anecdotes about him. There were some amazing photographs I found. But a lot of his personal story I was left to imagine, and so it was perfect for me to give myself permission to invent alongside the facts that I was able to find out about him. And gradually, he took over more and more of the story. At first, he was really kind of this hovering ghost, and then more and more, he foregrounded himself. So it was a lovely experiment for me to see how much could I research. I don't really think of myself as a research type writer, and yet I wanted to do just enough historical investigation to get the facts of his life right, and then invent around those facts and in among those facts. And so the character of Joseph Longboat, who in my novel is his closest friend, may have existed. I don't know. Nobody knows. But in my mind, he's as real now as Steinmetz is. And they had a remarkable friendship that lasted until their death, until Steinmetz's death.
And as you say, these characters of Steinmetz and Longboat, their lives really do reverberate through the story. And you move through time, mm-hmm. so that we as the readers are there with Steinmetz, but we're there with the contemporary or what I'm calling the contemporary right. characters, not contemporary to us today. And that's a tricky thing, I would think.
Well, you know, in the way that I said that Electric City is a kind of character in the novel, also the place itself is a character, I almost want to say that time is a character in the novel, too. I really felt that movement, that fluidity, that one of Joseph Longboat actually says, time is sticky like amber. And there's a lot of river, both literal and metaphoric use of the river in the novel, and the movement of the Hudson that flows both ways, you know, that time moves forward and backward. I mean, I've sort of investigated that before in The Speed of Light, the title of The Speed of Light referring to, you know, this notion that if you travel faster than the speed of light, you can be in two places at one time, the past and the present, and my realization that memory is like that. Memory is that fast and can make you feel as though you're in two places at one time. So in Electric City, I'm both in the time of the 60s and 70s, and I'm also in the time of the early 20th century when the world is becoming newly illuminated, literally, through electricity. And my town, my little hometown, had the nickname Electric City, and I just figured, oh, yeah, it's because of General Electric, that company that everybody's dad works for. And I never got curious about it until all these years later. And I love the grandiosity of the slogan for the town, which was, and still is, I guess, the city that lights the world.
And the three characters who are the focus of this coming of age, really do have the interaction of teenagers who are groping with feelings mm-hmm. and for each other and themselves in the world, and how they come to experience and, in fact, discover who they are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I chose them, as I said before, both because I wanted a representation of a certain kind of lineage, a certain kind of cultural presence in that town. You used the word confluence, which is a word I use in the novel too, because it's a very literal geologic term about the rivers, but it also really speaks about the confluence of all these different cultures and people coming together. And the idea that when you interact with people who aren't like you, it's an opportunity to think about who you are. That you know, some people grow up in really homogeneous places, and in some ways Schenectady, from some people's perspectives, is a very homogeneous place. It was not how I experienced it, because I was a first-generation American, and I was very aware of being different and being other. So I wanted all three of my characters, including Martin Longboat, who is indigenous to the place, and yet he's seen as other. Henry Van Curler, who's the descendant of this long lineage of Dutch settlers, but is very self-conscious about holding a particular status that makes him uncomfortable because he doesn't really take it personally. It feels like something imposed upon him by his family. And then Sophie Levine, as I said, like me, who is a first-generation American and trying to sort out where she belongs. And all three of them, they kind of ricochet off one another in some way as that process of self-discovery continues, and who is connected to who is more connected, who is less connected. Triangles, of course, carry a lot of tension. Whenever three people collide, you know, especially when there's some kind of romantic energy or erotic energy. So I used that in the novel as well to talk about how those layers of conflict or discomfort, friction, also help us figure out who we are.
And also, at the time the story is being told, the Electric City is turning. It's mm-hmm. on. It's on the downturn,
right.
And so there is this cycle that pulses mm-hmm. through the book that mm-hmm. way.
You know, when you were talking a few minutes ago about the coming of age part of the novel, it suddenly occurred to me, I don't think I've ever thought about it this way, that in a certain sense, the city had a coming of age, and then it lost its maturity, or it matured into something less exciting and thrilling than it had once been. It sort of peaked, you know, and that was happening at a time that I was, again, in my own life, partly aware of and partly confused by. There was this town that seemed to be calling itself significant, and this very significant company manufacturing appliances and tools that everybody was using, and yet the town was becoming more and more depressed economically, and things were shutting down and stores were closing, and so there was this way that the blackout of 65 in my novel, and I don't know if you can really say this is true historically, but in the novel I really use it as an emblem of a turning point when this bright future started dimming.
Yes, yes. I'm talking with Elizabeth Rosner. We mentioned your other books and this book, Electric City, but tell us about your book, Gravity, that is also coming out or is being republished. What's the
story? It's a new full-length version of my poetry collection, Gravity. I had a chapbook published years ago, but this is now a full-length collection. It's got a lot of new poems in it and some beautiful illustrations by Lola Fracknoy. And I call it I call it the autobiographical companion to all of my novels, because it represents poetry written over the past 20 years. I know some people get scared of the word poetry, but my poetry is very accessible, and there are a lot of prose pieces in the book too. And it's very much focused on all the different ways I reflect on growing up as a daughter of Holocaust survivors and the themes of science and innovation, themes of language and identity, themes about leaving home and finding home and falling in love and falling out of love. All of those themes that run through my fiction are present in that collection too. So I'm really excited to have them out together.
Anything you want to leave us with, Elizabeth?
Oh, it's been such a pleasure talking to you. I really feel like, can we keep going for another hour? It's such a privilege to get to talk about my work with people who read carefully and care. So thank you so much.
Well, it is my pleasure as well. So come back again.
Thank you.
My conversation with Elizabeth Rosner. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll hear from Jessica Barksdale Inclon. You're listening to KRCB's A Novel Idea.
If you're looking for the big adventure, and gold is all that's on your mind, if all you want someone to take your picture, then I won't waste your time. See, maybe I'm too quiet for you. You probably never noticed me. But if you're too big to follow rivers, how you ever gonna find the sea? So follow me. I'll be your river, river. I'll do the running for you. Follow me. I'll be your river, river. I'll move the mountains for you. Follow me. I'll be your river, river. I'm here to keep you floating. Follow me. I'll be your river, 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 yeah. Wherever you're standing, I will be by your side. Through the good, through the bad, I'll never be hard to find.
You're listening to A Novel Idea, and I'm Suzanne Lang. We've just heard Emily Sandé with River from her album Our Version of Events. Jessica Barksdale Inclon has just published her 13th novel. She's authored textbooks, and her short stories and poems appear regularly in journals, newspapers, and online. She teaches at Diablo Valley College, and her latest book from Ghostwood Books, complete with mouth-watering recipes, is How to Bake a Man. Here's my conversation with Jessica Barksdale Inclon.
You've got a new book out, How to Bake a Man.
I do. No men were hurt, though, in the making of this book. I have to tell people that, especially men.
But some of them might have gained a little weight.
That's the hope.
The book is, I don't know how you feel about us calling it chick lit.
Well, I think we have to call it something. Publishers and bookstores and libraries need to know, reviewers need to know what market it's aiming for. And it's aiming for the 25 to 35-year-old women. But I do have a nice 50-year-old woman in there, mother, sort of picking up for the rest of us to carry the story to.
And she meets a 55-year-old man.
I love it. When I wrote it, I wasn't as close to her age as I am now. And I am now a little older than she. So it all works.
And we're going to talk more about this book, much more about this book. The main character's name is Becca Muchmore, which I got a chuckle out of every time I came across it. But you actually are a real prolific writer, and you not only have other books that might be called chick lit, but you have some fantasy books and some family drama kind of books and a whole body of work. And some of our listeners and readers out there might not be familiar with that work. So how do you do it, for one? Some people spend 7 years writing one book. So talk a little bit about your work and how readers might encounter it.
Well, you know, I started as a poet, and I still write a lot of poetry. And then I moved to short fiction. And I guess what we call short fiction mostly is literary work. And as I moved into my first novel, Her Daughter's Eyes, I didn't think that I had changed anything. I was just writing the same kind of thing I had written about people and their stuff. And it was then marketed as women's fiction when NAL published it. And, you know, I was so grateful to be published. I didn't care if they had called it popcorn. You know, I would have just said, oh, thank you. You're publishing my novel. Well, I ended up writing six novels that were basically people and their stuff, which interests me to no end, what people are doing and thinking and feeling and the tragedies they overcome and the joys that they have. And mostly how I do it is because I had a really great teacher years and years ago, Anne Lamott, and she told our class, she just stood up, I think we were whining about how will we ever write a novel? And she said something like, 300 words a day in a year, you have a novel. And, you know, everyone really can write 300 words a day. Of course, that novel might be really ugly when you're done, but it's done.
So let's finally introduce our readers and listeners to Becca Muchmore and How to Bake a Man, which the title, to me, says it all in a way that she's wanting a man.
Well, Becca, I will just first say that I had nothing to do with the title because I'm notoriously horrible with titles of novels. I'm pretty good with short story titles. Novels? So editors have usually wrested control out of my hands. And when there were two options, How to Bake a Man, and the second was Sugar, Sugar. And when I read How to Bake a Man, though, I just started laughing. And I thought, you know, there is a lightness in this book, and there's enough sugar in it already. So I thought, oh, let's just go with How to Bake a Man. And Becca, I've been watching young women between the ages of 18 and 26 and 28, sometimes in their 30s, come back to Diablo Valley College and thinking, okay, that my only hope is school. This is the only way to save my life, to get me out of wherever I am. And I think a lot of the times it's absolutely true. But you know what? Sometimes college does not teach you everything you need to know to save your life. And she has one of those moments where, you know, I cannot go back to more school. So she relies on something that sort of saved her when she was a child. And it's something definitely I've always loved as well. So I, and my mother and my grandmother and my great-grandmother were bakers. This is one of their big roles in their families. So she just got all of that stuff from me and went off into the story with a mission to do that. And yes, we know early on in the first chapter that she's been unlucky in love, and that a man had to go all the way to Africa to get away from her, which is pretty much a sign. And that, you know, and sometimes love is hard to spot when it comes.
And she, like many people that age, I think she's 27, feels like she has no traction, really. And The book opens with her attending graduate school and realizing she can't do that. So part of it is her defining for herself, well, what can she do and what does she like to do? And baking is a big part of that because of that kind of family connection. And so it gives her comfort. And it sounds like she's a fabulous baker.
You know, there was a great poem by Amy Clampett that I have not been able to ever find again. But one of the lines was basically something to the extent of, if I can't write a poem, I'll make muffins instead. I think that baking is so creative and so satisfying. And it immediately pleases others.
And that's what she does. She forges her own kind of wobbly business with the support of some unexpected people. And she immediately encounters some people, one of them, which is her doppelganger, yeah. A woman who looks remarkably like Becca. So talk a little bit about that, because that to me is something that is sometimes used in literature, you know, twins or exchanged identities. And what made you come up with that?
Well, I was thinking that her doppelganger was maybe a view of what could go wrong if she'd taken the path down through business school. Or gotten a, you know, secondary degree in something where what we really want, we disavow for the thing we think we should do. And how that can twist our personalities into something that we are not. And so she comes across Jennifer Regan, who just appears formidable and scary and hard and yet perfect and wealthy and with the perfect man. The things that Becca has not been able to, like you said, no traction. You know, she has her degree. She had a job. I pictured her first job in a room sort of like a radio studio, dimly lit, doing her little, you know, Bartleby the Scrivener kind of work. You know, so this appears in this beautiful, you know, office building that they're in now that, wow, I could have had that, but then would I have been like her? So it's sort of an exploration of what could happen, what might happen. And then the realization is that nothing is black and white.
And she, throughout the book, is really struggling with confidence. And I think that that's an issue for many women. Confidence in business, especially in the face of other women who seem to have achieved something differently or more,
right.
And knowing how to be with men. And so that's some figuring out that she at times clumsily does in the story.
You know, a couple of the reviewers have said, why, she's just she's sort of neurotic. And I'm thinking, well, I guess that means I am. Because I stumbled around for a lot of my life looking like I knew what I was doing. I think people would assume I'd be in front of a classroom, I'd be doing whatever I was doing, and it looked really good. But inside, I was just, am I doing this right? Am I making any sense? Is anyone believing me? Will anyone do what I say? You know, so maybe I'm just a swirl of confusion. And I've always admired people who just sort of go through. And I also like an underdog. You know, I like a story of someone who doesn't recognize her own value and then is able to finally see her value. And maybe it's not the value that the other people around her have, but she recognizes it.
I think that is sometimes in life how it is. Other people see our gifts and our talents and our beauty, and when we don't.
Right. Right. We can't appreciate who we are. We're always comparing. You know, Krishnamurti said comparison kills. And I sometimes, when I'm feeling a little professional jealousy about something, I just think, okay, wait a minute. You know what? Just stop it. And then I always think everything's relative, you know, and we comparing is dangerous, but we do it naturally. In fact, that's what I teach students to do with writing and literature. Let's compare. You know, let's look at these two things. Let's juxtapose these. And if we do that throughout our whole life, though, we would never leave the house because we often, I think, especially women, feel that we don't stand up to the ranking of other people. And so Becca really battles with that. And she has this best friend, Des, who has been much more successful in figuring stuff out and sort of acts, I think, as a ballast, really, to Becca, like sort of keeps her on an even keel just to get through. And I really wanted this to be about also those relationships that sustain us.
And she has an interesting relationship with her mother that maybe she also doesn't recognize it for what it is,
right.
until the story evolves a little bit. And we see the mother herself, well, she met somebody.
I love that part. Well, I did, unfortunately. Fortunately, I did some online dating about 10 years ago and met my second husband. And truly, if I had to do it again, I would not. I would rather just stay inside and eat bowls of popcorn.
Despite the results. Huh?
Despite the results, because just online dating and date, you know, maybe it's just dating is just sort of I don't know what to call it. It did work. Yes, I love my husband and he's wonderful and we've been very happy. But the process of the coffee date kind of thing and definitely Becca's mother is not interested in going through. So I didn't really do any damage to her through the dating scene, which I tend to love. I actually wrote a short story recently where it was published last week, where there was, you know, these series of terrible dating experiences. But so, no, we don't have to do that in this book, thank goodness.
I want to bring up one of the other characters, Sal, who is Becca's neighbor and friend, and he's kind of a slick guy who smells good. And remarkably, supports her in ways that maybe are above and beyond what a neighbor would do, and helps her get her business off the ground, and he's kind of a colorful character.
I love Sal. He just really latched on to me, and he grew in terms of importance in the story and how he all of a sudden, you know, what I go, oh, well, there's Sal again. And Sal just kept moving on through the story. And he had very specific characteristics. And then he had all sorts of, I love his theories. Of course, because they're not necessarily mine either. The one that is my favorite is the theory of the 27 molds, that there are only 27 kinds of people on the planet. And they're just all various races, creeds, and kinds, but you can spot them everywhere. I'll actually give my first husband credit for the 27 mold theory. And so he ended up having all these theories. And because he was so persistent, he ended up having a bigger role in the novel than I imagined.
Well, and it was satisfying. He was a satisfying character throughout the book. There was also, and he's kind of representative of it, her business is supplying baked goods in a office building. I mean, to just put it that way. She's got a food cart. and she gets involved with some of the people in this in the law firm that she serves. And there was a real, to me, difference between these lawyers and kind of highbrow business people, and her and Sal and some of the other characters who are making a living.
Yeah.
And her maybe crossing into that sphere as part of her finding out really where she belongs.
I would guess it's a class statement, a statement of class, where I do think Becca, you know, in terms of her education and her father's money that she and probably her mother's expectations should be up with the lawyers doing something. And I hope it's not a statement about lawyers. I mean, lawyers are very useful, but I really just the idea of money. And when I got divorced, you know, the amount of money one pays a lawyer, it's astounding. So I hope it's not that. But it's also this idea that, you know, Maslow and his hierarchy of needs. So we do have our two homeless characters in this novel. And Vic and Hallelujah Jones. And I think they're really there in a way because they're not there as clowns, but they are there in a way observing this world that goes by them up into the office buildings every day. And that Becca connects them to the office in a sense by giving them food. And there's some kind of money out there that I don't have. And people who have a lot of money do start doing things that people who don't have money just can't do in terms of what they wear and where they go and where they live. It's a big difference.
And her Becca's wardrobe comes up more than once in the book.
Yes.
I'm talking with Jessica Barksdale Inclon about her latest publication, How to Bake a Man. And before we go, I wanted to ask you about, in a book like this that has some mild sex scenes, and I'm just always curious how, as a writer, you approach that and pace that, and what do you say, what do you reveal, what do you not reveal to make it an interesting encounter?
I have a great, I think it's great. And in fact, it's one of the best things I've written and in terms of being online. And it's now on storyacious.com. It's called Writing Sex Scenes, because I've thought a lot about it in terms of romances. I don't like to read sex scenes that do all the stuff that is predictable. I don't like the gasping and the heaving and the thrusting. And one of my first teachers said to me, no fluids are allowed in any of your writing. And I took that to heart. What I'm most interested in are the emotions that the characters are going through. And I also then tell people to think about the parts of the body that are not thought about in sex as much. Like, what, you know, what is your baby toe doing at this moment? I'm being a little facetious, but, you know, we really go for lips, areas on the body that we know are involved. And I think we're all pretty tired of it. Also, the euphemisms of the body parts, like velvet purse and stuff like this, that are just horrible. They're cringeworthy. And I don't also want to, if I'm reading a book, I think I'm reading a book. I really don't want to read erotica. If I want to read erotica, I will go and find it, or I'll go find my pornography. Not that I watch, but you know what I'm saying? If I want to do that, I will pick that kind of book. I think it's just really flowing from character, plot, and theme, staying away from the body parts that are overused. And again, as Kate Braverman said, no fluids.
But give us, the reader, just enough to make us feel warm and fuzzy.
Yeah, warm and fuzzy.
Yeah.
Like, look, those two people got together. And I'm not opposed to fade to black either. You know, I'm not, that paragraph can end. I can think about it, though, for a couple of hours afterward, that kind of thing.
We're talking about How to Bake a Man. And Jessica, how can readers learn more about you and your other books?
Well, I have a website. It's my full writing name, Jessica Barksdale Inclan. That's INCLAN.com. And all my books, you know, as we do, they're all there. There's little buttons where you can click. There are some blurbs and some links so that people can preview if they'd like. And also there's a contact page if you want to talk to me about anything. I'm happy to read your email and also hear about any recipes anyone's making.
And lastly, since it seems like you're writing and publishing all the time, and even though you're just launching this book, what might we see from you next?
The hope will be I have my, and this is a story really dear to me right now. It's I just finished a novel titled The Burning Hour, and it's about the main character is an 84-year-old a Native American / Indian woman, depending on who I'm speaking to, and a 24-year-old wildland firefighter who are both in northeastern Nevada, and the streams of their plots cross over. And I have spent three years writing this one, and it's right now with an agent, and fingers crossed on this, because it's about the environment. It's about the wildland firefighting and the ecosystem. It's about identity, who we are as Americans. It's also my firefighters grappling with confidence and how to be the man he wants to be. And my Wanda Mapp, my 84-year-old Indian woman, is dealing with the changes in the land and the changes in her tribe.
Well, we'll look forward to that.
I hope we do.
Jessica, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jessica Barksdale Inclan. And earlier in the broadcast, we heard from Elizabeth Rosner. You can hear my expanded conversations with both of these authors by listening to our podcast online. Follow the links at krcb.org. And you can subscribe and listen through iTunes. We've had production assistance from Sean Knight and Mary Moore Campagna. Thanks for listening. I'm Suzanne Lang, and it's a novel idea.